What a lovely spot, Latimer. Nothing like a peaceful expanse of water to soothe the soul. Did you write this sign?
No, ma'am. Adventurers beware. Lair of the gazebo ahead. I wouldn't write something like that.
How odd. Oh well, let's press on to the shoreline. Wait a minute. What's this on the path? Oh, this is awful.
Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman.
There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril. Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't lost your significant other to Dragon Age Inquisition. I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea there for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and, of course, a nice cup of tea. So here we are at Loch Lomond in beautiful Scotland, and already I can feel the stresses and strains of recent events lifting from my shoulders. The deep blue sky, the sunshine sparkling on the water, the bird song. This is just what we all needed, I'm certain. There are enough folding chairs for everyone, and a few deck chairs that Latimer brought too, should you wish to relax even more. If the sun is too much, then join us under the gazebo. And if you could be darlings and keep an eye on the tree line, I'd be very grateful. I'm sure I saw some people up there as we walked down to our picnic site, and it's making me a little nervous.
I've cleared away the biscuit wrappers we found on the path, ma'am. Bourbons and custard creams. What is the world coming to? I also found this icosagon. Someone has numbered each of the sides, and it appears well-worn.
An ico... Oh, Latimer, that's a D20. I can put that to good use.
Very good, ma'am.
Oh, and Latimer, I'm sure I saw a group of people hiding in the tree line over there. One of them was wearing a wizard's hat, and another was wearing armour. They're not going to be any trouble, are they, Latimer?
I will ensure they're not, ma'am. Your guest has arrived, a Mr. Drew Carpishan.
Oh, splendid. Let's see his calling card. Drew Carpishan, writer at large. And a nice design of a quill pen and a golf club in an X. How lovely. Show him over to the gazebo, Latimer. For those of you who don't know, Drew Carpishan is a writer of computer games and novels, including his own fantasy series and Star Wars and Mass Effect tie-in novels. He worked for BioWare for 12 years, during which time he worked on several games, and was lead writer on Knights of the Old Republic and Mass Effect 1 and 2.
Mr. Drew Carpishan, ma'am.
Hello, Drew. Do come and sit down. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Isn't it just the most beautiful spot?
It really is. I've never been to Scotland before, so it's quite impressive. The greenery is fantastic.
Yes, very majestic scenery. Would you care for some tea?
Yes, I'll try tea. It's not my usual beverage, but I'm willing to make do with the local.
Oh, so if this isn't your usual beverage, I suppose you're not sure about sugar or milk or...
I'm going to guess I need as much sugar and milk as possible.
Oh, really?
I've got a bit of a sweet tooth, so we'll go heavy on the sugar and milk.
Okay, well, I'll start off with two lumps of sugar, because it would be a terrible crime to over-sugar it, and then you can add some more at your discretion.
All right.
So I'll pour, and I was wondering if you might like some traditional Scottish shortbread to enjoy with your tea.
Oh, that sounds fantastic.
It really is splendid stuff. Latimer made it for us this morning, and it just melts in the mouth. It's phenomenal. Mm. So here we go. You're not allergic to chickens, are you?
No, I am not.
Oh, excellent. Well, we'll just leave them scratching around by the shoreline. They seem to like it here as well. They're very happy. Now, in my invitation, I asked you to bring a curio with you. What have you decided to bring today?
Well, I decided, because many people know me because of my work with Star Wars through my books and video games, that I would bring a custom-made hilt of a lightsaber that I received.
Oh!
So it was a gift for the team that worked on the Star Wars Old Republic game, And it's really quite spectacular. If you can see here, it's got some metal with a mixture of some inset gems. And
wow.
The decoration, the symbols that are carved onto it are very Sith-like. So it's very appropriate.
Now, appropriate? Is that something I need to know?
Well, just because I'm sort of known for doing stuff with the dark side and the Sith, that's sort of been my my claim to fame in the Star Wars universe. Now, fortunately, this one does not ignite, so you don't have anything to worry about.
Oh, that's good. Yes, Latimer did look a little bit nervous over there. It's all right, Latimer, don't worry. So it was because of your work in the game, not a comment on your character. That's good to know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really quite remarkable artifact. It's really beautifully made.
Yes, they're quite impressive, actually. And I've definitely taken a lot of pride in this one. It goes on the shelf where everybody can see it.
Yeah. So you're a storyteller, and you've told stories in the form of computer games such as Knights of the Old Republic and Mass Effect 1 and 2, and you are also a novelist. Now, they're two very different media, and I was wondering what advantages computer games have over novels in terms of delivering a story.
Well, I think the great thing about computer games, especially in the latter part of my career, when I first started, the industry was still pretty young, and we didn't have all the advantages, but now it's very much more of a cinematic experience. You get the full impact of voice actors and a musical score and digital acting with your characters. So you get all the benefits of say, a film or a screenplay, but you have one extra advantage when you're working in games, and that's that the player is the main character. So everything has an urgency and an immediacy that you don't even get in, say, film. Because in film, you're watching what happens to a character. In a game, it's happening to you, at least in the BioWare-style games. So I think games allow us to get a much deeper emotional hook into the player. And everything we do has an incredible impact, which I think is why people react so strongly to story in games.
Yes. And do you think that novels have any advantages over games?
I do, in that with a game, there's a lot going on. It's not just about the story. Whereas with the book, readers go in specifically for the story. So I think you can get a lot deeper in a book. The story can be a little bit more, I don't want to say complicated, but it can have more layers. You can get a little bit deeper into some of the characters. You can dig down in a way that you can't in games because there's too much other things. There's too many other things going on in a game. Players can get their focus is constantly drawn to what else is going on. So I definitely think there's advantages to both.
It must be really interesting having done both, and not just, you know, any old game, like really, really big deal games. I'm really fascinated by the difference in kind of process. And in terms of games on a scale of Mass Effect and Knights of the Old Republic, how do you handle writing games of that scale in the team? Do you divide up kind of sections of the universe and meet up to tell each other what you're just, I don't even know where I would start.
Well, it is something, I mean, we definitely learn to do it over time, but we kind of do take that approach. On the Star Wars or Mass Effect writing teams, we had anywhere from 5 to 8 writers at a time, and as lead writer, I would have to make sure everybody kind of stayed on course and everybody's individual work together, but we would give people a specific planet or a specific character and say, okay, you are the writer responsible for this. And then as the lead writer, I kind of have to smooth everything out and make sure it all fits together. And I write everything that connects all those sort of individual planet stories. So, for example, in Knights of the Old Republic, I would do anything that involved Darth Malak. And in the Mass Effect games, I would do anything that involved Sovereign or the Reapers, sort of the main overarching story. And then the other individual planets are sort of standalone stories that the other writers are more responsible for.
So do you see it as something akin to a showrunner?
You know, that's
a big TV series.
That's a good analogy. I mean, I probably don't make as much as a successful showrunner, but otherwise, that's a good way to look at it. And then, of course, you have to you know, coordinate with all the other departments as well. You know, you have all the level design, of course, but also your cinematics teams and, you know, the art team. So there's a lot of time spent when you're writing in games in making sure that, you know, all the other departments are working together as well. And fortunately, BioWare was a great company to do that. Everybody respected Story. I've heard horror stories of other game companies where the writer's locked in a room by themselves and you never interact with the team. And I think that's a very difficult way to write stories for games.
You know, it's interesting you say that because at a convention last year, I went to see a really interesting talk by two quite prominent writers in AAA gaming. And I went there thinking, oh, I love games and I am a novelist and this is something that I could see myself branching out into in the future, fortune being with me. But after that, an hour of listening to them talk about it, I walked out of the room thinking, there is no way on earth I could ever write for video games because of the horror stories they were telling about having kind of like levels already programmed and all rendered up and all sorted and then them being brought in like the last third of the process and saying, well, can you make a story out of this? And that was supposed to be underwater, but it has to be with lava now because the water engine wasn't working right. And I just thought, oh, no. In BioWare, was it story first?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I don't know if it was story first, but it's definitely equal to all the other parts of the game. And, you know, BioWare was a very special environment in the gaming industry. We were always in the office full-time, integrated with the other teams. I've heard many stories similar to the one you were telling where writers maybe aren't even on site, they aren't on location. They check in every month and, you know, touch base to see what's happening and find out everything's changed and, you know, they have to redo everything. And it's very difficult to make a solid story that way. There probably are a few examples using that method, but I think most of the successful stories, you have to integrate the story into the game. And companies are slowly learning that. It sounds like it's getting better, but I think the industry has a long way to go still.
Yeah, and obviously it depends on the game as well, because there are some games where it isn't so relevant and
yeah,
other games where it's really, really important.
Yeah, when you're doing like a BioWare-style story where it's a branching narrative where the player helps control and guide the direction of the story, it's just a whole other layer of complexity. So I don't think you could even attempt something like that without writers directly involved with the rest of the team.
No, definitely not. Oh, I'm sorry. Latimer, could you go and speak to those people over there? I think one of them looks like he's about to fire an arrow at us. I've no idea. I'm so sorry, Drew. I think they must be... I don't know if they're tourists. I don't know. Would you go and see to it, Latimer?
Very good, Mom.
Anyway, I'm sorry. So if the story of your life was turned into a computer game, what kind of game would it be?
Well, in a good way, it would be a very boring game. My life has been pretty easy and pretty straightforward. You know, I haven't had a lot of drama or excitement. If anything, it would be like the old text game that they used to have when I first started in computers called Executive Office.
Okay.
Where you had to make decisions about your career and the point was to try and end up rich and wealthy. that's pretty much all I've done.
So you walk into a room, you see that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And then it would give you a little scenario and... You know, how do you handle this? You know, a lot of it was about ethics. You know, do you screw over one of your coworkers to get ahead? And then would that come back to haunt you? It was a fun little text game.
Cute. It wouldn't be guns or a platform or anything like that then. That's good to know.
Yeah.
that's nice. So if you had a choice and if both were actually real, which universe would you prefer to live in, the Star Wars one or a Star Trek one?
Well, now let me ask you this. Do I have an affinity for the Force? Am I like a Jedi or am I like an average person?
Oh, I couldn't be so cruel as to say you live in the Star Wars universe and not have any affinity with the Force. That just seems mean beyond measure. So, yes, of course, you do.
Well, I think then I would go with the Star Wars universe because they... You know, having that advantage would kind of make me one of the elite. As much as I love Star Wars, there's a lot of elitism built into the framework of that universe. So
yep.
If you're part of the special few, I think it would be good, although I wouldn't be a very good Jedi. I'm not very disciplined. I would be, as we referred to earlier, I think my tendencies lean a little bit more toward the selfishness of the Sith. I don't think I would go full on evil dark side, but you never know.
So if you didn't have an affinity with the Force, would it be Star Trek all the way?
I think so. You know, Star Trek is, at least from my perception, is a much more utopian place to live for the average person. You know, I mean, if I was a red shirt on the crew, that might be the worst place to be. But as a general, you know, living my day-to-day life, the people in the Star Trek universe, I think, seem to have it a little better. Star Wars can look a little grubby sometimes if you're on some of the outer worlds. And if you're in the, you know, the capital, it can be a little bit overwhelming. It looks like there's a lot of class striations, and I wouldn't want to be in the lower rungs of that.
No, not at all. So when I take tea with friends, what I like to do is to ask friends and ask our patrons if there are any questions they have. And a very lovely chap called Ron Davis would like me to ask you what advice you would give to anyone starting up an indie games company.
Ooh, that is a tough one. Now, I have not done that, partly because it is a very, very difficult, career path. I would say the first thing you're going to have to realize is you probably won't make money on your first game. It will probably be long, long hours. And I think you have to be ready for the heartache of not having it be as successful as you want. On the flip side, it would be very rewarding creatively. But I think the biggest mistake I've seen with indie games and even with larger AAA titles is people overreach. You are much better off doing a few things well instead of doing many things poorly. Mm-hmm. And that's just endemic in the game industry. Too many games try to do too much, and they don't do it well. Simple done well is much better than complicated done poorly.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. In fact, that could probably be extended to several different
really
kinds of careers.
It really can. It's kind of my life philosophy, really.
Do you miss life in AAA gaming? I hear it's really quite intense.
You know, it can be. BioWare was getting better. When I first started, we put in crazy amounts of overtime because that's just how it was. You know, we loved our project and we wanted to put as much work into it as we could to make it as good as we could. And we weren't very good at managing the schedule, so the overtime did wear us down. But we got better at managing that. And I definitely miss the camaraderie. Being a novelist is a more solitary pursuit. You know, I still have friends, but much of my time is spent alone, either researching or writing. Whereas because of the way the teams were set up at BioWare, you were constantly surrounded by friends and coworkers who shared your interests. We had a lot of common things that we liked, you know, very much the geek culture that is now, you know, celebrated at places like Comic-Con was constantly there, and it was just nice to be with people that you shared that with. So I do miss that a little bit, and if I ever do go back into games, it will be because, you know, I want to work with those fantastic people again. And you also reach a huge audience with games. You know, even a best-selling book might sell, you know, a tenth of what a really big-selling game would sell. So your audience is much, much larger, and as a creator, you want people to see your audience. So that was one of the things I kind of missed as well.
Yeah. You've already brought up about the fact that you have a different life now as a novelist, and not only that, you've moved away from kind of space opera to fantasy. Is that right?
Yes, I've been working for the last few years on a fantasy trilogy called The Chaos Born. The first two books are already out, and the third one is now written and with my editor. So it's a real trilogy. It's not going to turn into one of these trilogies that becomes five books and seven books, and it's not going to take me, you know, 15 years to finish. I'm not going to name names, so the story is done. And it's always something I wanted to do. It was sort of a nod to the authors I grew up reading, the fantasy authors, and probably most specifically Terry Brooks. The Sword of Shannara, depending, I'm not sure how you say it, on this side of the pond. And
I've heard both.
David Eddings, and even the Dragonlance novels, which were something I read as I was growing up, and I just loved. So those are sort of the three main influences on the story I'm telling.
Mm-hmm. And do you think you'll stay in fantasy, or have you got books in other subgenres bubbling away?
I kind of jump around anything in the sort of spec fic, science fiction, fantasy, and actually horror. I'm a huge fan of horror. I love Stephen King. I love Clive Barker, horror writers. And I do write horror. I've written some short stories. And there is a little bit of darkness even in my fantasy or some of my Mass Effect novels or Star Wars novels. There's some rather graphic, gruesome scenes, which is sort of a calling back to the horror writers that influenced me. But I mostly stay within the spec fic genre of that kind. For me, if it's something that could happen in real life, I'm usually not as interested in writing it because I think, well, I'll write something that is impossible. That's one of the advantages of writing, is you can write things that aren't real and can't possibly happen in the real world.
Oh, yes, I completely understand that. I can't read horror because I'm a bit too much of a Bertie and I get a bit too scared. I tried when I was a teenager with Misery, and it got to the bit with the hobbling,
and
I could hear his voice pleading with her not to do it, and I just had to close the book and then just really, I'd never gone back.
Now, did you ever watch it on film, like with Kathy Bates and James Caan?
I've seen little snippets over the years, but I haven't sat down and watched it from beginning to end for the same reason, because I can't watch horror either, because I'm just such a Nancy. It's just really, really appalling.
I enjoy reading horror. Watching horror, I have a little bit of that reaction that you do. Well, sometimes I like to have that little scare, but for me, reading horror is easier than watching it.
See, I don't understand. Why would you want to be scared? Life is scary. Why would you want more scary? Well, maybe it's kind of a safe.
I think
scary.
It is. I think it's sort of that cathartic, you know, you get the feeling of scare, but you know it's a safe environment. It gets your blood pumping, and afterwards there's kind of that relief when the scare happens on the screen and you react, and then you kind of almost laugh at yourself after, and...
But the thing is, for me, it never stops at the end of the film. Like, it seems so many people, they switch it off and go, oh, that was fun. And then they do other things, but I will be terrified for days afterwards. So I just just got the wrong wiring for it. So I don't know if you've heard about these rather remarkable chickens. They look like normal chickens scrabbling around over there.
I've heard some rumors, but they're hard to believe.
Yes, they are hard to believe until you hear it in person. So... what I like to do is to ask my friend Taking Tea, if you had a theme tune for your life, what would it be? And we'll see if the chickens know it.
Well, you know, I have a couple. One has already been done, I believe, if I remember, with one of your other guests, which was the Imperial March from Star Wars.
Yes, the lovely Mike Cole.
So
yes.
I think I'll let him have that. There's a tune that many people... probably are familiar with, although you maybe don't know the name of it. It's called Powerhouse by a man named Raymond Scott, and it became very popular during the Looney Tunes cartoons era. People often hear the music when there's a scene of the cartoon characters running through a factory, things like that. And it's something that, I don't know, I always find myself humming it as I'm going about my daily life. So I don't know. We'll see if the chickens, if I can stump them or if they know that one.
Okay, let's see. Little chickens, Raymond Scott's Powerhouse. Oh, and there they go. They know it.
That is amazing.
It's like they're running through a factory. That's incredible. It's an amazing piece of music, actually.
It really is. I've seen some people on YouTube looking to play it on a piano, and it's one of the pieces they say you can't do by yourself. You need two people to do it.
I've only seen an orchestra doing it, and it was such a rambunctious, wonderful, chaotic piece. I loved it. So I'm just going to check. Oh, I'm afraid the teapot is empty.
Oh,
but there is some shortbread left. So shall I wrap some for you?
That would be spectacular. I will never turn down shortbread.
Neither will I. It's a very good rule to live one's life by. I noticed that you have a set of golf clubs with you.
I do. I am a hardcore golfer, and I could not come to Scotland without bringing my clubs.
Well, fabulous. I understand that there's a golf course on the other side of the lock. If you'd like to borrow our motorboat, feel free to have it for the rest of the day and zip off and play some golf before coming back home, if you like.
I will definitely take you up on that offer. That's fantastic.
Ah, wonderful. Well, if Latimer could put the shortbread into the boat for you, and could you be a dear and put his golf clubs in there, Latimer?
Yes, ma'am.
Lovely, thank you.
What is the etiquette here? Do I tip him for that?
Oh, no, my dear chap. We're in the United Kingdom. No, it's one of those things that's been changing over the years. You don't need to tip Latimer. In fact, I would recommend that you don't, okay, because I don't quite know how he would react. Just a nice, genuine smile and a thank you would suffice. In a restaurant, 10%, but not Latimer. Just the thought is enough to make me smile. But anyway, it's been such a pleasure to speak to you.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm definitely going to enjoy my round of golf, and I would love to come back anytime.
Oh, yes. I'm sure that will be able to happen at some point in the future, and we will take tea together once more. And best of luck with the third novel. May your editing notes be gentle.
Thank you.
Take care now.
Bye-bye.
What a lovely chap. There he goes, off to play golf, and the lake is as still as glass. That's a relief. Oh, those people have come back, and they don't look very happy.
I'll deal with this, ma'am.
I'm preparing to charge it.
That really is quite enough. It's just a gazebo. I'm gonna cast a couple of fireballs at the damn thing. Burn, baby, burn. I'm warning you. Spell casting. F-I-R-E.
It's the shotgun of Vecna! Run!
I'm sorry about that, ma'am.
Thank you, Latimer. I was just watching Drew through the binoculars. He's about halfway across. Can you see him?
Ah, yes. I can, ma'am. Along with the head of that monster, rising up out of the lock behind him.
But this is Loch Lomond. There aren't any monsters here.
I had heard rumours that Nessie had grown tired of all the fuss at Loch Ness and moved here for the peace and quiet. It seems the rumours were true. Fancy.
Oh no. She looks angry. That motorboat must be upsetting her. Cut the engine, Drew!
He can't hear you, ma'am. He seems more interested in his golf clubs.
What is he doing setting up a shot in the middle of a lake?
He's having one last putt before he dies. Very civilized.
Four!
Nessie's going after the ball. It's just like the T-Rex in Jurassic Park. She must be attracted by the movement. Drew's getting away.
A cunning strategy. It looks like he'll reach the opposite shore before she realizes what he's done.
Well, thank goodness for that. Time to go home, I think, Latimer. Whilst Latimer is tidying away the picnic, I'd like to raise my teacup to Craig Warner and the other members of the Order of the Sacred Teacup. Should you wish to join the esteemed order and discover how Latimer became my butler, go to www.patreon.com/TeaAndJeopardy. And for those of you who are listening before Christmas 2014, I'd like to invite you to check in at www.tnjeopardy.com, where you will see something special for you every day of Advent. Well, Drew's made it to the opposite shore, and Nessie has gone back underwater. Latimer, would you be a dear and arrange transport for Drew to get home after his round of golf?
With pleasure, ma'am.
And Latimer, find a new location for the tea there, would you? Somewhere monster-free, perhaps?
Very good, ma'am.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman, co-written with Peter Newman. Go to www.teaandjeopardy.com to find previous episodes, and www.patreon.com/teaandjeopardy to become a Bless Poppet.